Small businesses are the cornerstones of our local communities, and small business owners are hardworking and passionate people who are chasing down their ambitions while there's a lot on the line. So, let Verizon champion your small business dreams. Whether you own a small business, are scaling one, or starting one from scratch, you need Verizon Small Business Days. From April 22nd through April 28th, you can partner with Verizon business experts for small business support. During Verizon Small Business Days, you can receive a free tech check with a one-on-one meeting with a Verizon business expert. Plus, Verizon business experts will provide you with personalized advice and solutions that are tailored to your specific small business needs. Take advantage of special offers and deals during Verizon Small Business Days and get more for your business. Verizon, well, they've got you back. Don't miss out. Book an appointment today. Just call 1-800-483-4428 or go to verizon.com/small business.
So why do you want to learn a new language?
I'll tell you why. Because ¿dónde está el baño? Can be a very important question at times. You know, Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. Fast track your language acquisition with immersive lessons designed to teach you to pick up languages in a natural way. I love the fact that I can go from my laptop to my phone to pretty much anywhere and learn the language of my choice. Not to mention, I'm bringing my communication skills to new heights. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, StarTalk Radio listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/StarTalk. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/StarTalk today.
Welcome to StarTalk, your place in the universe where science and pop culture collide. StarTalk begins right now. This is StarTalk Sports Edition, and this time we're doing a Cosmic Queries grab bag. Got with me Chuck O'Reilly. Chuck.
Wow, you just
Chuck Nice.
You just married us, and you married us. And somehow I had to take Gary's name. What does that say? What is
Chuck
going
Nice.
On here?
Gary O'Reilly. I think of you as my one common conjoined co-host. I'm sorry. So,
yes,
Chuck Nice.
Dr. Frankenstein, good to have you there, man. Good to be here.
All right. Gary O'Reilly, former footballer from the UK and broadcaster.
Yes.
And we got a little piece of him for us. Very good to have you. This is a grab bag. And anytime we have a grab bag, this is like the bat signal going up into the clouds. We got to reach for our geek in chief. The one, the only. Hold your applause till the end. Charles Lou! Charles!
Hey!
Okay.
Hey, Neil. Hey, Chuck. Hi, Gary. So good to see you guys.
A friend and colleague, astrophysicist Charles Lou, who's a professor of astronomy and physics at the City University of New York in Staten Island. And always good to have you here. You're a fan favorite. And so you're going to help us in this grab bag. I mean, I might be able to do some, but when it comes to really geeky answers to cool questions, I am unworthy, and I will just sit back while you take the mic.
But I'm happy to be here. It's always fun, and the questions are always the best.
They're always cool. They're always cool. So, Gary, Chuck, you got questions lined up?
Yes. Right. Let's start with one of our very favorites, and I can't do the voice anywhere near the abilities that Chuck has, but it's Alejandro Reynoso.
No, give it to Chuck. Why are you reading that, Chuck?
I didn't know we were starting here, so I got to pull up Alejandro.
Pull up the message. So again, all of our cosmic queries today are exclusively asked by Patreon members with our new entry level category of $5 a month. So you can't argue with that.
All right, here we go. Let's start it off with our friend Alejandro
Reynoso, who comes to us from Monterrey, Mexico. And he says, hello. Or should I say, hola. My question is, how do you think we can use artificial intelligence in exploring the universe?
So there it is. So Charles Liu, what do you have to say about AI and our field?
Alejandro, let me tell you, you are right on the mark. And in fact, we are already trying to do precisely this. As many of you know, I am part of the Cosmos collaboration working with the James Webb Space Telescope. Neil, you're familiar with that. Back when we were working on it with just the Hubble Space Telescope data, right? Mm-hmm. But now we have a James Webb Space Telescope.
Just to be clear, the Cosmos collaboration is a consortium of people and institutions that have targeted sections of the sky and others just to hammer it with as many kinds of telescopic observations and detectors as possible to learn basically everything knowable about sections of the sky that we target. So continue. So now we've applied this to the James Webb. So what do you have going?
Well, the James Webb Space Telescope's first season's most significant observing project is to use the James Webb to aim at the cosmos field, which you described so aptly just a few seconds ago. And so we are spending 270 hours of James Webb time in just a small patch of sky about the size of your pinky fingernail.
At arm's length.
Yeah.
At arm's length. That's
yeah,
right.
When you're not right up close. But like, when you're looking up at the sky. Right.
Yeah. Pinky at arm's length. Not finger in your eyeball. Right. All right, good.
Yeah, that would be difficult. So there's literally terabytes and terabytes worth of data coming from all the different observatories around the world. And James Webb is just layering on that next layer of information about this patch of sky. And no human being can individually process all of that information in any meaningful way. So what we need instead is the opportunity to use machine learning, deep learning, artificial intelligence, to help us make sense of all of this incredible amount of information. So for example, we have information about possibly 2 million or so galaxies within this cosmos field, ranging all the way out to 13.5 billion light years away.
Just to be clear, this fingernail at arm's length blots out 2 million galaxies on the sky to the edge of the universe.
Each of these 2 million galaxies has thousands of pieces of information about it that have been gathered by all these telescopes that have been trained on it for the past 20 years. Off and on. And now we've added James Webb on top. Can we make a pattern? Can we understand what actually matters? Can we ask ourselves, can we look at all 2 million of these galaxies and find something new? Actually, probably not. But using artificial intelligence, we can do that. We can say, here are the parameters of what we think are normal. Can you please find for us all the normal things and then all the abnormal things? And then tell us what is normal and what is abnormal, or should we be looking at that allows us to sort of understand the change of the galaxies in the universe from 13 billion years ago to the present day? I mean, that's a heady question, which any individual human can sort of grab the most creative and interesting ways, but processing all of that information, AI is the answer. Wow. We're not there yet.
So Charles, why isn't this just more powerful computing rather than what people generally today think of as AI? Because we've always needed computers ever since computers have been brought to our field. We've needed it to reduce and analyze massive amounts of data, even when massive amounts of data in the day was only a kilobyte or megabyte. And so now we're up to terabytes. So isn't it just more powerful computing?
Number crunching?
Yeah.
As opposed to thinking.
Right, yeah. Is it really thinking?
Number crunching has been going up. It actually is extremely important. And you're right. That's most of what computers are doing for us in astronomy today. But it's that next step. I think it started maybe 3 or 4 years ago that we really started shifting over toward machine learning and artificial intelligence. So both are still working hand in hand together. And you know, in the current circumstance, the AI part is still in its infancy. A lot of times when people publish scientific results that they found using AI or machine learning, they're probably not right. But we publish them anyway because we say, hey, it might be right. Please let us, let the rest of us colleagues go back and check to see if what this machine found is actually something in reality.
The all-important verification step.
That's right.
Right. And so compare all of that to neural nets.
Mm-hmm. Well, neural net is just another way that we can abstractly map the idea of intelligence and pattern recognition, right?
Right.
Current...
Because we think that's how our brain works. That's why we say neural, right?
That's right.
It's just the connectivity to find patterns and whatever it is that might manifest.
That's right. The neural net itself is a pretty complicated thing, but we can strip it down to very basic components and say, can you do a one-dimensional or two-dimensional or three-dimensional discussion about all this information, try to make connections that we otherwise wouldn't be able to see if we were just trying to use one CPU by itself, you know, one brain or one processing unit. The neural nets in our brains are not just three-dimensional. They're 4, 5, 6, 10, you know, each neuron attaches in many unusual ways to many others. Right. So there's a sort of an emergence of awareness that comes about from you have these networks of that kind of complexity. So these are the things, I think you did a Cosmos episode on this, right, Neil, once?
Yeah, we
about
did, yeah.
How intelligence and the concept of a very complicated neural net like a human brain can actually be more complicated than even an entire galaxy worth of stars and their interactions and so forth. Yeah. It's very, very powerful, but poorly understood.
All right.
Are we looking for the right things? I mean, using AI obviously should be an advantage, but are we looking for the right? Because there must be things out there we don't know exist, but we should be looking for, but we don't know to look for them. Is AI going to be able to assist in us in that kind of capture of data?
Mm. In other words, can it discover what it's not looking for?
Right.
Thank you.
It can discover what it's not looking for. That's a great question. It can discover what it's not looking for if we tell it to look for things that it's not looking for.
Right.
Mm.
So in a sense, your number crunching, right, data reduction or say computational work, that will give you the answers to things that you are looking for. Right. Now you tell a machine and say, these are what we are looking for. Can you tell us any exceptions to what we found?
So anything, it would have to be something anomalous, but wouldn't you have to program the parameters of what an anomaly is in order for...
No. You only have to know what we're familiar with, and anything...
Well, anything else would be an anomaly.
In that box,
right,
would be an anomaly.
That is an anomaly. So, okay. So that means, that is kind of like intelligence.
That's the easiest part of the, easiest part of the job. Yeah. If it doesn't fit, stick it in a box.
It goes, oh, that's odd. Okay, now let's look at that. Okay.
In fact, 60 years ago, one of our colleagues did that. He looked at all these beautiful galaxies in the night sky. It was a beautiful spiral and a beautiful elliptical-shaped galaxy. Who ordered this one, which was tangled and mangled? And he made a catalog of just the tangled, mangled-looking galaxies. And it was called the Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies. And it was just, it was the catch basin of nothing that fit anything else. And Charles, you remember, it became one of the most studied catalogs in the canon of cosmology.
Alton C. Arp, Chip Arp's Atlas of Peculiar Galaxies, published in 1966. Yes, tremendously interesting. And what it was it turned out that Chip Arp's ideas of why they looked peculiar were incorrect. But by putting them together into a catalog, people could look at them and start wondering and thinking about what actually was going on. And it helped us understand that galaxies collide, that they crash into each other, and they create amazing structures which we could not have imagined had they not collided. And that led to the entire field of computational astrophysics as applied to galaxies.
And by the way, we needed the computers to make that happen. So that was in the 1970s, computing power rose to then say, well, I wonder what a galaxy would look like if it collided with another galaxy. Hey, that matches ARP's catalog number 32.3. And then you look at it at a different angle. That's a different object in the catalog. And so all of a sudden, we ought to explain all the galaxies just as witnesses to train wrecks.
You guys keep saying collide. When you say galaxies collide, is it that the galaxy's gravity affects another galaxy's gravity? Or are you looking at actual objects hitting one another? Because aren't galaxies so spread out? What is it? What's an actual collision?
Ooh, Chuck on the case.
Mm. Beautiful, ooh, beautiful question. One, when galaxies collide.
When galaxies collide.
That's a movie title right there. We need that one.
Yeah. The stars are so far apart that they almost never hit each other directly. So it's like swarms of bees or hornets, you know, nests, swings right through one another and affecting one another from a distance.
Okay.
But a collision doesn't have to happen only when a physical object hits another physical object.
Okay.
What you said, the gravitational effect of one object affecting the other is indeed as much of a collision as we might think of, say, two vehicles hitting one another or something. And so instead, you get these twists and turns, you get bends, you get loops and whirls, and it is all gravitational. Yes, indeed. So it's really
So we count a gravitational encounter as a collision because they affect each other. But I've quantified this bee analogy. So if there were four bumblebees flying randomly across the continental United States, the chances of them accidentally bumping into one another is the same as two stars colliding in two galaxies. So yeah, basically two stars are not going to physically collide, but they'll all feel each other's gravity, and that's enough to make a train wreck. So
and a beautiful train wreck they can be. These kinds of train wrecks cause the formation of new stars, new planets. Sometimes in the billions at a time, they feed supermassive black holes. They create quasars and active nuclei. They're one of the most important engines of the evolution of the universe itself.
Wow.
The engine of the evolution.
Look at that.
We got to take a quick break. When we come back, more Cosmic Query Grab Bag. We'll be right back.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. So you need a business partner just like you, like FedEx, who understands your passion for serving your customers because they have the same commitment towards you. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the US on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. What's more, FedEx Ground is faster to more locations than UPS Ground. Trust FedEx for timely deliveries. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.
Whether you're a family vacation traveler, business tripper, or long weekend adventurer, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. And that's good, because there are a lot of me's. Choice Hotels has over 7,400 locations and 22 brands, including Comfort Hotels, Radisson Hotels, and Cambria Hotels. Get the best value for your money when you book with Choice Hotels. Cambria Hotels feature locally inspired hotel bars with specialty cocktails and downtown locations in the center of it all. Hey, that's me. Radisson Hotels have flexible workspaces to get the most of your business travel and on-site restaurants. That's me, too. And at Comfort Hotels, you'll enjoy free hot breakfast with fresh waffles, great pools for the entire family, and spacious rooms. Hey, that's me, too. I guess I'm just going to have to stay at all of them. Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Book direct at choicehotels.com, where travel comes true. Do you want to set up your child for success? Of course you do. Maybe you want to save money on private tutoring, or maybe it's just out of your budget altogether. Is this a big school year for your child? Like maybe they're starting kindergarten, middle school, or high school, or some other milestone. Maybe your family moved and they're starting at a new school. Is your child ahead? Not getting challenged enough in class? Well, we love that little smarty, but we want them to be engaged. IXL Learning is an online learning program for kids covering math, language arts, science, and social studies. IXL is designed to help them really understand and master topics in a fun way. Powered by advanced algorithms, IXL gives the right help to each kid, no matter the age or the personality. There's one site for all the kids in your home, pre-K to 12th grade. Kids can use it at home on the computer or on the go through the app on your phone or your tablet. No more grading those worksheets. IXL grades everything itself. And no more trying to figure out how to explain math equations or grammar rules yourself. IXL has built-in explanation videos. 1 in 4 students in the U.S. are learning with IXL. IXL is used in 95 of the top 100 school districts in the U.S. Make an impact on your child's learning. Get IXL now. And Star Talk Radio listeners can get an exclusive 20% off IXL membership when they sign up today at IXL.com/StarTalk. Visit IXL.com/StarTalk to get the most effective learning program out there at the best price.
We're back. Star Talk Sports Edition. Cosmic Queries Grab Bag with our geek in chief, Charles Liu. All right. And of course, Chuck and Gary. Give me some more questions. We're on a roll here.
Okay. This one I think is pretty topical. So this is from Samuel Fairchild. Greetings from San Antonio, Texas. What can we learn from the runaway supermassive black hole that was spotted by the Hubble telescope trailing a 200,000 light-year-long tail of new star formations? Answers, please.
Ooh. Ooh.
It is most likely a classic example of what happens when galaxies collide.
Galaxies collide,
yes. Lots of things can happen.
In a galaxy far away?
Yes. They could be far away. We hope they're far away, but they could be close by. Remember, in a few billion years, the Andromeda galaxy will collide with the Milky Way. Then we'll have a close-up view of what happens when galaxies collide. So the story is this, right? You have a galaxy, and it's about 100,000 light years across. Here comes another galaxy that's also 100,000 light years across. They hit each other at just the right angle, and you can pull a trail of gas outward a couple 100,000 light years long.
Wow.
When that happens, you're basically creating a stream of new stars forming all along this trail. And so there's your 200,000 light years long trail of new stars forming. Meanwhile, part of that collision could have hit. And, you know, there are many different ways galaxies can collide, but perhaps at just the right angle and at just the right speed, the supermassive black hole in one of those galaxies got stripped out of the body of the galaxies that are colliding. So whereas the rest of the galaxy's material is sort of coalescing into a single blob, that supermassive black hole is out on a trajectory that looks like it's following that gas going outward. There's a lot of possibilities, and we've only just begun to figure out what's going on.
And by the way, the gas, unlike the stars, the gas doesn't really pass through itself. When the gas collides, it's like two hot marshmallows sticking. So a lot of interesting things can happen in the gas part of the colliding galaxies, separate from the stars.
Right. You can often think of the gas in a galaxy like the water in a swimming pool or something. Right. They have a dissipative force. They are viscous. Even though they're very sparse by Earth standards, they wind up out in space sort of along the millions of years type time scales and the millions of light years type size scales, acting very similarly to what you might expect.
So Charles, I did an episode of Nova Science Now once where it was exactly that reference. I was at a swimming pool and I had a bucket, if I remember this correctly, I think I had a bucket of ping pong balls and so did someone else. And we tossed them towards each other and only a few of the ping pong balls would hit each other. But then I had buckets of water and we threw the buckets of water at each other and the water it was there, as you said, it's dissipative. And we did it in slow-mo, and you can see it. It was pretty cool. All right, keep going. What else you got?
All right, next question up is from Mo, M-O-E. Aloha, Neil and Chuck. What evidence can you provide to show that we aren't in a simulation?
Aren't.
Are not.
Ooh. Oh, interesting. Ooh. Proving the negative. Can you prove the negative?
Oh, okay. I have an attempt at it, but go on. I want to hear what my geek in chief has to say.
Ooh. René Descartes, yes. Hundreds of years ago, right? The guy who after whom we've named the Cartesian coordinate plane, but also a great philosopher, a rationalist of his time.
Right.
I think, therefore, I am.
Yes. That's him. That's right. He basically set out the idea that if there were a simulation that was good enough, we would not be able to tell. There's just no philosophical way to tell as long as the simulation is good enough. So the only evidence that we can give that we are in a simulation is if somehow we see a glitch. You may remember the movie Inception, when the people in the dreams were trying to figure out whether or not they were in a reality or not in a reality. And one particular person figured out that he was in a dream because the texture of the carpet was different from what he remembered in reality. Right. Ooh. So every single piece of evidence out in the universe has to be consistent with what we think is real. Right. And if not, if there's a glitch, then we're in a simulation. We can also go to The Matrix and talk about that. And how the reason they were able to know they were in a simulation was because something just didn't happen correctly. That's the only way, according to Descartes, that we can prove that we are in a simulation. But how can we prove we're not in one? You just have to keep looking for the glitches.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
Wait. So if we don't find any glitches, we're either not in a simulation or it's a perfect simulation. And therefore, what's the point of even distinguishing the two?
Well, then, would that line up with paranormal activities counting as a glitch?
Ooh.
So paranormal activities are not, following the laws of nature, or physics, or what have you. Would that count as a glitch?
Listen to Chuck.
That would listen say that we are.
So what are we calling a glitch?
Or
what's the definition?
Yeah. Or a miracle. A miracle is something that happens outside of the laws of physics.
Miracles and paranormal activity at this point in our understanding of the universe are only things that we don't understand yet. There's nothing that's been shown to be conclusively a violation of the laws of physics. Just something that we haven't explained the rest of physics yet.
Wait. Jesus walking on water violates a ton of laws of physics right there.
If that actually happened.
Well,
shots fired.
In all defense, he has some really good sandals, okay?
Yeah, Jesus sandals.
He had Jesus sandals now.
Jesus sandals.
So we all have to think about these questions as skeptically and as optimistically as we can at the same time.
Okay, I got to add another pop culture reference. My single favorite episode of the 2.5 seasons or whatever it was of Black Mirror was the episode titled Hang the DJ, which has nothing to do with the entire story. It's the name of the song that you hear at the end. In that, it's a dating community. You date multiple people to see who one you like, and then at the end, you get married to them. And we learn, should I give it away? I have to give it away, otherwise I can't talk about it. We learned that all the people in this story are being simulated. But you don't know this because you're with them, and they're testing their dating, and oh, that didn't work out. Let's date another. I got to stay 3 months with this person. It's all prescribed, and it's all do it, and they hate each other, or they love each other, whatever. And one of the people, one of the women who likes skipping rocks, skipped rocks and said, every time I skip rock, it only skips 3 times. And she said,
oh, so she figured out the glitch.
Some should skip 1 and some should skip 4. Mm. She just tossed it up. And you don't even know to pay attention to that when that's happening. All right. These are characters that have their own sense of free will. And one of them noticed that every time she skipped rock, it was exactly and identically 3 times. And we later learn that all of these people are a simulation so that when at the end you emerge and the two people, they escape they escape this place. And as they escape, you see the digitization of things happening. And the next scene are two people meeting up in a bar who were matched by that simulation. It was so like,
it's the ultimate swipe left or swipe right.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
But so the simulation tested everybody's compatibilities. And it was like, oh, my God. But in it was that one observation. So ever since then, and a little bit before then, I've been checking for things that maybe should have different kind of variation than what should. That's interesting about the carpet, though, Charles.
But do we then project our desire to find a glitch into our thinking and observations?
Without question, Gary, that's a great point.
Mm. So it creates a bias.
Ooh, we humans are biased in one direction or another in general, right?
Yeah.
And just like it's very hard for all of us to be rational all the time, and maybe we shouldn't be, the circumstance is of our detecting whether we're in a simulation or not are almost secondary in importance to whether or not we are in whatever environment we are, real or simulated, and live the way we want to live and do the things we want to do.
So in my recent book, Story Messenger, I reflect on what a simulated world would be, and I use that as evidence that we're not in a simulated world. You know what it is? A simulated world is created by computers, and computers are absolutely logical. And so, no set of computers would ever create the world we live in. So it's the inanity defense. It's like, Earth is inane in every way. Computers have higher integrity than that, even in a simulation. That's my evidence.
That's great evidence, except that you may be putting too much stock in our inanity. It may well be that inanity is an inherent part of logical systems.
Okay, Neil, would a computer be able to generate or recreate love?
Oh, yeah.
I don't see why
easily.
Not.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't see why not.
Depends on what you think love is. Depends
on what you think love is. I got this. I'm past that. Okay. So watch. You get everybody who's in love with something or some other person, right? Mm. And then you do a brain scan. And I'm making this up, but it's plausible. You do a brain scan, and everyone has the same part of their brain lit up while they have these feelings of love.
Right.
Then you take someone who doesn't have those areas of the brain lit up and show them something that's completely neutral. Right? Like a book, just a book cover or something. Then you light up that part of their brain and see if they fall in love with the book. And if they do, we know exactly what love is. It's the neurosynaptic of this section of the brain. There it is. And we can create it for you if you want it. If two people are long marriage and they're falling out of love, go back and re-stimulate. They're back in love if they're like newlyweds.
Yeah. I mean, clearly love is a neurochemical synaptic function of the brain.
Yes.
I mean, it just has to be on a biological level. Otherwise, you know, I mean, you can attach ethereal qualities to it, yes. But, I mean, people who, if you are brain dead, you can't be in love, period.
Right. In fact, you don't have to be fully brain dead. You can be partly brain dead in the section that would matter in that category. Right.
But and sometimes it makes no sense.
As a matter of fact, we have people who are incapable of love, okay? We call them sociopaths.
Yes.
And or they're incapable of empathy.
Capable of empathy, but you have to have empathy to have love. So
imagine a person imagine a person that is somehow perhaps what we might call defective and unable to experience empathy or love. This person carefully studies thousands of people who are happily in love, figures out all the behaviors that are observable from an outside person of how to be a person who expresses and shows love, and then just mimics all those behaviors beautifully. Running into a person or choosing a person to treat that person that way, to work with that person that way, to do the things with that person that all those other people in love are behaving. Is that person exhibiting love to another person?
It is not
a part of the brain. That's why we go inside your brain with the brain scan.
That's what a brain scan is for.
That's the whole point of the brain scan.
If you don't have that part of the brain lit up, but you behave as if that part of the brain were lit up, are you still behaving with love?
So I'm going to say from a utilitarian standpoint, no, you are not, because the only reason you would do that is because somehow you are being served. Otherwise, you would not be a sociopath. You would actually be exhibiting love itself.
Right, perhaps your definition of behaving in a way that's self-serving is to behave in a way that everybody else in the world looks to you as if you are in love. But then are you? You may not be from your brain's point of view,
That's why I introduced you to science here, where you go inside the brain. But that's the whole point of that.
I'm asking you a different kind of science. Mm-hmm. From the observable perspective, assuming no hidden variables, okay, assuming that the interior of the brain is unknowable.
I'm not have to assume something that's not true.
But quantum mechanics, for example, suggests that indeed there are things about particles at certain levels which are not observable.
And I agree, but we're talking about your brain and not a particle.
But can your brain behave in that way if the brain were considered not something that you can poke and prod? What if love, in fact, does not light up the same part of your brain?
All right, when we come back, more Stark Talk Sports Edition. Cosmic Queries with our geek in chief, Charles Liu. We'll be right back.
Is there such a thing as a traveler? Not a Delta. Because we know on one flight, Mike in 8C prefers reality TV to reality. So we provide more than 1,000 hours of in-flight entertainment. While on the flight after, 8C is occupied by Jen, whose favorite snack is tea. That's why we provide fast, free Delta Sync Wi-Fi available for SkyMiles members. Because at Delta, we know. Refill? Everyone flies their own way. Delta, keep climbing. Free Wi-Fi available on most domestic flights. Terms of use apply.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel Chewable Tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
When something happens to your car, you might say,
"No! My car!"
But what you really need to say is something that can actually help.
Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
And just like that, State Farm is there to help you file your claim right on the State Farm mobile app. So, just remember, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
We're back. Star Talk Sports Edition. Cosmic Queries Grab Bag with our geek in chief, Charles Liu. Charles, how do we find you on the internet?
Oh, well, at Chuck Liu, ChucklIu on Twitter, and at The Luniverse, Thelunivers, on a wide variety of platforms.
The Luniverse.
Yeah. Podcast is going, wherever you get your podcasts. We have lots of conversation and fun with that. Yeah.
All right, cool. And Chuck Nice, you're still Chuck Nice comic?
Everywhere, sir. Thank you.
Everywhere. Cool. Gary, are you still Three Left Feet?
Yes, I am, on Twitter.
On Twitter, all right.
My Three Left Feet, all words.
My Three Left Feet, yeah, got it. All words. Sorry. So, we got more questions here. Bring it on.
We have, right. Matt Berg says, hello from Sheboygan Falls. I believe that's Wisconsin.
Sheboygan.
You're welcome. I have used many of your discussions in my classroom to have my middle school students think a bit deeper about things.
Teacher in the house.
All right. Is there a simple... So, here we go. Pay attention. Is there uncomfortable? Sit up straight. Is there a simple way to explain? Well, I'd start now. Is there a simple way to explain to students what our universe is expanding into? In other words, if the Big Bang Theory created everything in our universe, does that mean that there has to be something outside of our universe, or how can there be a nothing that is being expanded into? At this moment, this gentleman, Matt Berg, his mind starts to hurt.
Ooh, That's not so bad. There's nothing wrong with a head hurt. Yeah.
Have you know that a friend of mine who is a doctor, graduated from Ivy League school and Stanford and stuff, asked me that very same question not that long ago. Nice. So you are in good company, Mr. Berg. Here's my way of explaining it. You are at the center of the universe right now. When we make measurements and try to figure out where the center of the universe was that it was expanding out of, it always goes to you. Whoever is observing observes that they are the center of the universe. So in other words, we are part of the Big Bang. When the universe was microscopically tiny, that is what has become us today. There's no central point because we're at the center. The center just happens to have gotten really, really big. And that's one way of thinking about where the center of the universe is. You are the center of the universe. I'm sure your mom told you that at one time or another, or you thought that you were that at one time or another.
I loved when she told you that.
Yeah. That's right. In fact,
all right, so what are we expanding into? Because that's what it started. Hmm.
The expansion into, you can think of as a different dimension. You can think of it as, say, space being three-dimensional, length, width, and height, expanding into a fourth dimension, which is not, yes, a fourth dimension of space, which is not length, width, or height. Or you can actually think of it as a four-dimensional space-time where the expansion direction is in time, Neil, where t equals zero. At time zero was the Big Bang. The universe was very small. And now time has gone on. T is about 13.8 billion years. And now the universe has expanded in that fourth dimension of time. You can find lots of different ways of thinking about it that are mathematically equivalent. So maybe if you're not like exactly getting the way that I'm describing it, maybe the way that you foresee it or think about it or envision it is just as mathematically valid as the way that I'm talking about it right now.
Wow, that was elegant, Charles. I got to give it to you. That was...
I can't take credit for that.
Really cool,
well,
man.
Well, thank you, Chuck. But you know, remember, I didn't come up with this, right? Our scientific forebears, you know, have been working on this for a long time. And when they first came up with these ideas, they were hard-pressed to explain them and understand them because they're so different from what we thought about when we were in those times.
I'd like to add to it that you can have a multiverse where everybody's expanding, but if you're embedded in a higher dimension, then you will not necessarily collide, even if you can go to infinity.
Right.
So if you take a sheet of paper and send it to infinity in every direction, so it's an infinitely large sheet of paper. Now I can take another sheet of paper, lift it off of that into a higher dimension, a third dimension.
Right.
All right. And now it's just, quote, parallel to the other one. That can go to infinity and never intersect the other sheet.
And I could do that into infinity.
To infinity.
And beyond.
To infinity. And beyond. Yeah. So,
wow.
So if you embed our three dimensions into a higher dimension, you can expand higher dimensions, and then they'll never collide if they're all in a dimension yet higher than themselves.
Interesting.
So there you have it.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
All right, another question. Let's keep them rolling. We're on a roll. So what else we got? Is it Gary or Chuck? Who's got the next question?
Okay, Gary.
Okay, you want another one? Just like the other one.
Bring it on.
All right, Kartik. Kartik is from Germany. If the Earth's magnetic field is caused by the iron inner core rotating within the magma outer core, how does gas giant planets like Jupiter also have a magnetic field? Do we know anything about the composition of the interior of the gas giants?
We do. And the answer, we think at this moment, is that far enough down in a gas giant like Jupiter, the hydrogen, which we think of as a gas, turns into a metal.
Ooh.
It becomes what we call metallic hydrogen. And so you have a core of metal, of conducting stuff that can swirl, just like the core of metal in the Earth. And that's how you can get a magnetic field.
Just to be clear, we didn't pull this out of our ass. If you remember your
what do you
periodic
mean,
table
we,
of elements. If you remember your periodic table of elements, hydrogen is, if it's a full fleshed out table, hydrogen appears twice, once in the upper left and once in the upper right. once in the upper left is hanging out with the metals, and in the upper right is hanging out with the gases. And if I'm remembering that correctly, Charles, is that right?
It can be written that way, yes.
Written that way. And I said, well, why is it twice? And somebody said, well, sometimes it's metallic. And I said, it's a freaking gas. What the hell are you talking about? Later, I would learn under pressure behaves just like a metal does, just like iron. And so, yeah, so it doesn't have an iron core, but it's got a metallic hydrogen core under all that pressure for sure. And there it is, running a dynamo on Jupiter, a rather ferocious one at that.
Sweet.
Oh, yeah.
Look at that. Mm-hmm. That was good.
We got one more in there. Quick one. Let's get a quick one.
A quick one. Okie dokie. Let's see. Pim Bilek. I was wondering what you think is the biggest obstacle for developing working warp drive, and would you see this becoming a reality? And if yes, when? Curious about Charles' theoretical view on this.
Ooh.
Impatient yeah. Patreon
so,
member.
Pim, mm-hmm. Here's the answer. Charles has already built a warp engine in his basement. That's
uh-huh.
And he can't tell you when it's going to be released because he can't tell you. You know, that's classified information.
The 1.3 gigawatts are still missing. Well, let me see. Okay. The thing that is most blocking our ability to create a warp drive quickly is physics. The actual ability to travel faster than light at this point through the universe that we have right now, we don't have it. We don't have that ability. So you have to find a way to travel through space, but not in the way that everything else travels through space. So can we actually do what the Star Trek folks are thinking, or Miguel mm-hmm. Cubieri said, where you create a subspace field and you put yourself inside a warp bubble which can travel through space faster than time because the warp bubble can, but you can't, mm-hmm. right? Or is it some other way where you actually have to exit our three dimensions and go into a fourth spatial dimension and then come back in? These are the questions. The basic fundamental physics are still beyond us. We can imagine. We can have fun with it
on
television.
Give me a date when we're going to have it.
Next Wednesday.
Next Wednesday at 3 p.m.
According to reliable sources, the date is April 5th, 2063. That is according to Star Trek First Contact, the movie where Picard travels through time and goes to the Borg.
He goes back
and sees Zefram Cochrane in Montana. Right.
The right. one who invented the drive.
That's
correct.
Right. And the Vulcans came.
And the Vulcans just happened to notice
it. And they picked up his warp signature.
And that changes all of human history. Right. That event happened on April 5th, 2063.
Okay, well, there it is then.
Wow. That's
the day.
I got to tell you, that was amazing.
Let's get reality imitating art.
That, yeah.
And make that happen. All right, I'm going to put that in my calendar right now, right when we're done here. All right, Charles, always good to have you, man.
Thanks so much.
All right, love to the family. And Chuck Nice, always good to have you there. Gary, all
a
in
pleasure.
Here.
Thank you.
All right,
pleasure.
Star Talk Sports Edition, Cosmic Queries Grab Bag. That's like the randomest fun anyone can ever have.
Yeah.
I think. We just did.
Yeah.
All right, Neil deGrasse Tyson here. Thanks for listening. And as always, keep looking up.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you gotta check out NexGard Plus, afoxolaner, moxidectin, and pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease, plus it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored, soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus Chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurologic disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting a preventive.
Home isn't just a place. It's a state of mind, like curling up in a comfy chair as you watch the world go by.
Good afternoon.
Which is why at Delta, our people do our best to make you feel at home long before you get there. Delta, keep climbing.